All right, let's go to D under Romans 2. At Sinai, Exodus 19 to Numbers 10. In Exodus 19, the Israelites arrive at Sinai, and in Numbers 10:10, they leave Sinai. So the remainder of the book of Exodus, all of Leviticus, and the first 10 chapters of Numbers, all take place at Sinai. It's about a two-year period. I have on the outline there a number of subpoints. First is the establishment of the Sinaitic covenant, Exodus 19 through 24:8, with what, 2, 4, 6 subpoints under that. The first of which is the covenant presented, Exodus 19, verses 3 through 8. They arrive at Sinai in the first two verses. Now you see they set out from Rephidim and come to Sinai. And then verses 3 to 8, I think we should read. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the house of Jacob and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites." So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words that the Lord had commanded him to speak. The people all responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. Moses had known ever since his call at the time of the burning bush out there in the wilderness that Israel would worship the Lord at Sinai. If you go back to 3:12, God said, "I will be with you. This will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain." Now, go back to the beginning of the chapter 3. They came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Horeb and Sinai are two different words for the same place. So this is Mount Sinai. In chapter 6 of Exodus, the Lord told Moses in verse 6 following, "Therefore say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians, I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and mighty acts of judgment." There's the language of redemption again. But then verse 7, "I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am Yahweh your God who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians, and I will bring you to the land I swore with uplifted hand to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Verses 6, 7, and 8 are really programmatic, you see. "I will bring you out of Egypt," verse 6. Verse 7, "I will take you as my own people." That's Sinai. And verse 8, "I will bring you into a land." So, bring you out of Egypt, establish you as my people, that's Sinai. Verse 8, bring you to the land. Verse 7 is being fulfilled when we get through Exodus 19. Because what we read here is, in verse 5, "If you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations, you will be my treasured possession." That word, treasured possession, really means God's own property. You will be my treasured possession. You notice that's introduced with a conditional statement, "if you obey me." And that question, or that conditional statement should raise a lot of questions about how it is to be understood. Those of you familiar with the old Schofield Bible notes may be aware that in that Bible, the note for 19:5, if you obey me, says what under law was conditioned is under grace freely given to every believer. And the suggestion of that note is that the basis for God's relationship with his people in the Old Testament was really law, while the basis for God's relationship to his people in the New Testament is grace. And you get law set over for this. And you get the idea that Israel really should not have done what they did in verse 8, where you read the people responded, "We will do everything the Lord has said," because that same Bible said that Israel spoke rashly by accepting the law. They really shouldn't have done that. Now, look at your citations, page 19, where I have some paragraphs from Walter Kaiser's Toward an Old Testament Theology, where he speaks about this conditional statement. He says, "Was this covenant a deliberate change from the promissory covenant of the patriarchs to a conditional covenant in which obedience was the absolute condition of blessing? Could this be interpreted as a step downward and a mistake tantamount to rejecting God's gracious dealings with them? What was the relationship of the if statements, Exodus 19:5 and similar ones in Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 11, and the command, 'You shall walk in the way which the Lord your God has commanded you, that,' in Hebrew, Laman, 'you may live, and that it may go well with you, and that you may live long in the land which you shall possess,' Deuteronomy 5:33. The contrast implied in these questions was too sharp for the text. If the alleged obligatory nature of this covenant should prove to be the new grounds for establishing a relationship with the covenant of God, then it should prove possible to demonstrate that the same logic can be applied to the conditional statements noticed in the chapter on patriarchal theology. The if is admittedly conditional. But conditional to what? It was a condition in this context to Israel's distinctive position among all the peoples of the earth, to her mediatorial role and her status as a holy nation. In short, it could qualify, hamper, or negate Israel's experience of sanctification and ministry to others, but it hardly could affect her election, salvation, or present and future inheritance of the ancient promise. She must obey God's voice and heed his covenant, not in order to live on as a purpose clause, live and have things go well for her, but with the result that Lima'an, as a result for her, she will experience authentic living and things going well for her. Deuteronomy 5:33. So, I think you have to be careful. We'll come back to this in a few minutes about how you understand that conditional statement. The conditional statement is not suggesting that Israel has traded grace for law, because the only reason Israel is at Sinai is because of grace. I have delivered you up out of the land of Egypt. I have redeemed you. I have brought you to myself. Now, here is what I expect you to do. So, the Lord says to them in this initial presentation of the covenant, If you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. You will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. I want to come back to that expression, treasured possession, because it comes up elsewhere in the Old Testament, as well as with the Septuagint translation of it. It comes up in the Greek of the New Testament, following the Septuagint translation of this phrase in the Old Testament. The word translated treasured possession is segura. And it's a feminine noun that means possession or property. It's a rather rare Hebrew word. But it has turned up in a cognate language, that is another Semitic language, in a Ugaritic letter. Where it's used by a Hittite suzerain, great king, to describe the king of Ugarit as his segura, his private property. So here's the great king of the Hittite Empire who uses this word, segura, to describe a vassal king, the Ugaritic king, as his own possession or private property. So the basic meaning of the word is to set something aside as one's own property. It is used here, it's used in Deuteronomy 7:6, where Moses says, "For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his segula, his own private possession." That's Deuteronomy 7:6. Deuteronomy 14:2. "You are children of the Lord your God. Do not cut yourselves or shave the front of your heads for the dead. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. Out of all the peoples on the face of the earth, the Lord has chosen you to be his segula, treasured possession." Deuteronomy 26:18. "And the Lord has declared this day, you are his people, his segula, his treasured possession, his private property, as he promised. And that you are to keep all his commands." When you get into the New Testament, look at Titus 2:14. Verse 13 says, "We wait for the blessed hope, the glorious appearing of the great God and our Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all wickedness, and to purify for himself," NIV says, "a people that are his very own." A people that are his very own. And the Greek there is identical with the Greek used to translate segula in those places in the Old Testament we just looked at. So it's the same word, except the Greek wording. "A people that are his very own, eager to do what is good." Now it's interesting. Those of you familiar with the King James Version, you know how that's worded? Does anybody know? Yeah. "Who gave himself for us to redeem us from all wickedness and to purify unto himself a peculiar people zealous of good works." Now, peculiar people. Why would King James say peculiar people? Well, in Old English, peculiar meant belonging to an individual or privately owned. So there you see an enormous shift in meaning of a word. And I think at the same time you see a good reason why we need more up-to-date translations that use English the way it is used today rather than it was 400 years ago, because otherwise, you would say what many people think anyway. Christians are peculiar people. They're, but not peculiar in the sense of the Lord's possession, but peculiar in the sense that they are odd in some way, which is not the meaning of the word at the time the King James was translated. 1 Peter 2:9 is another use, and I think this shows some of the continuity between the people of God in the Old Testament period, the people of God in the New Testament period. 1 Peter 2:9, you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. And then the next phrase, a people belonging to God. And the Greek of that is the translation of segula again. It's a people who are God's own possession. Now he's speaking there about the church, people of God in the New Testament years. But in this first presentation of the covenant to Israel, God says, you are my own treasured possession. And you are also to be a kingdom of priests. That's the next expression that's descriptive of what Israel is to be. What are priests? Priests are mediators between God and human beings. And I think the idea here, Israel is to be that sort of a vehicle. Israel is to have that sort of a function to the nations of the earth. As subjects of the kingdom of Yahweh, Israel is to perform a priestly task among the nations, to be mediators between God and other human beings. And then thirdly, the Lord says, you are to be a holy nation, a nation set apart from all others. The Hebrew word kadosh, its root meaning, it's often translated holy, but it is apartness. A nation set apart from all others. So that's the presentation of the covenant. B is arrangements for declaration of moral law in verses 9 to 25. Just a few brief comments here. Israel is warned in verse 12 that they are not to touch the mountain. Be careful you do not go up the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. He shall surely be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on him. And in verses 16 to 18, you have a description of God's appearance on Mount Sinai. There was thunder and lightning. Verse 16, with a thick cloud over the mountain. Everyone in the camp trembled. Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God. They stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace. The whole mountain trembled violently. The sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. And Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered. The Lord descended on the top of Mount Sinai, called Moses to the top of the mountain. So here you have Sinai, enveloped in fire and smoke and lightning and thunder. And you see a certain continuity here in manifestation of the presence of God. If you go back all the way to Abraham, remember in chapter 15 of Genesis, there were those animal carcasses that were slain and laid out. And this smoking fiery furnace passed between the parts of those slain animals. And that smoking fiery furnace was really a theophanic symbol. It was God who was taking this self-maledictory oath upon himself. So be it done to me if I do not fulfill the promise that I have given to you. It's a ritual of the conclusion of the covenant. So you have that smoking, fiery furnace in that covenant with Abraham. And then with Moses, in Exodus 3, you had the burning bush where God appears to Moses and commissions him to go back and deliver his people, and that appearance of the Lord is also connected with fire, and Moses is told, don't draw near, put your shoes off your feet, the place where you stand is holy ground. And it seems like when you get here at Sinai, what you have is the burning bush on a much larger scale, but it's the same sort of phenomenon. When the Lord appears on Mount Sinai and speaks again, and then in verse 25, well, it's 24, the Lord tells Moses, go down, bring Aaron up with you. The priests and the people must not force the way to come up to the Lord, or he will break out against them. Moses went down to the people and told them the words of the Lord. And that is the foundation wall. That brings us to C. Chapter 20, verses 1 to 17. The Ten Commandments. And as I mentioned earlier, you speak of the categories of laws being moral, ceremonial, moral, civil, and ceremonial. I think a better label is foundation law for the Ten Commandments. I think what you have in the Ten Commandments are laws that define the eternal principles by which God intends man's life to be normed and governed. Eternal principles that God has given to govern our lives. I don't think these principles were given to Israel as a means of meritorious salvation. I don't think that was their intent. And that's not the way they should be viewed by us today. But as I mentioned earlier, election is not only to privilege, it's also to obligation. And God had chosen Israel as his people. He had redeemed them from spiritual and physical bondage in Egypt. He had brought them to Sinai. And now at Sinai, he gives his law. I think you can say there's a sense in which the law itself is a revelation of God's grace to his redeemed people. You know, often law is set over against grace, and I want to say more about that later. But the very fact that God has given these principles to guide man in his life is an act of grace. Look at your citations, page 22. This is a paragraph about the middle of the page from, again, J. Mortier's Old Testament Covenant Theology. He says, what does that mean for us as we seek to study these narratives as a covenant document? It means this, that the Word of God to a redeemed people is a word of law. We are enabled by this simple observation of a sequence of events to get in biblical perspective the place of law in the life of the people of God. God brought them to Sinai that he might declare his law to them. In the Old Testament, therefore, the law is not a ladder whereby the unsaved seek in vain to climb into the presence of God. The law is a divinely given pattern of life for those who have been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. These folk who had rested underneath the sheltering blood, who were committed there by the pilgrimage, discovered that the immediate objective of their pilgrimage was the place where they might hear God speak his word of law and of commandment. The law is a pattern of life which God sets before and upon a redeemed people. This is the place of law in the Old Testament. Is it not the place of the law in the New Testament? Ought we not, therefore, as believers, increasingly to forget the blank page between Malachi and Matthew and to read the Bible as one book proclaiming one message? Now that shows that perspective, continuity between the Old Testament and New Testament when it comes to this matter of law and grace. You know, it's been typical going back again to certain dispensational sorts of emphases to say the Old Testament law was New Testament law. And the implication is there's little grace in the Old Testament. I think the perspective is law and grace function in the Old Testament in the same way. I want to go further with this because this issue has become a rather large issue in evangelical Christianity generally. Look at page 23 of your citations, bottom of the page, and over on the page. No, it's another one. Just this statement at the bottom of 23, and then we'll go further with another one. This is from an article by Gordon Lennon, Grace and Law in the Old Testament, and where he says, throughout the Old Testament then, law is consistently set in the context of covenant. This means that law both presupposes grace and is a means of grace. You know, reflect on that. Law set in the context of covenant. This means law presupposes grace and is a means of grace. Law presupposes grace because law is only revealed to those God has called himself. See, God has called Israel to himself. He brought them out of Egypt. He's born them on legal terms. Now he gives us law. But grace precedes law. Law is a means of grace because through obedience to it, the redeemed enter into a closer relationship to their divine king and enjoy more of the blessings inherent within the state of salvation. So, law presupposes grace and is a means of grace. Look at page 20. This is another section from Mohir, where he says something very similar to what Mohir says there. This is on the nature of Old Testament religion. Old Testament religion is a complex of, notice his words here, grace, law, and grace. Let your mind go back over what we have seen together in Exodus. We have seen the grace that brought them out of the land of Egypt. The law that was spoken to them because they were redeemed people. And the grace that was made available for them as they committed themselves to a life of obedience. See, that's grace, law, grace. Notice how this solves thorny problems which have been raised by Old Testament specialists. For example, the supposition that there was a battle in Israel between those who thought that religion was purely a matter of the cult and the sacrifices, and those who thought that religion was purely a matter of ethical observance. It cannot be so, because the Sinaitic Mosaic groundwork of Old Testament religion is the binding together of grace, law, grace. The binding together of the commitment to obedience and the blood of sacrifice. Naturally, when the prophets found that sacrifices were getting out of place, they countered that by reasserting the priorities for the people of God. The prior call was to holiness. And within that context, the blood of sacrifice makes provision for the lapses of the people.
It is around this point the totality of Old Testament religion finds its unity. The unity of the Old Testament and New Testament. 1 John 2, 1 and 2 reads, "My little children, these things I write to you that you sin not." People of God under the New Covenant have no permission to sin. They are summoned to a life of holiness. All that the Lord has said, we will do and be obedient. What Israel said when they heard the law at Sinai. "But if any man sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. He is a propitiation for our sins. God has made a provision whereby those who are committed to obedience may, in spite of their disobedience, still be kept at peace with God and maintained in the covenant relationship." Is it not so that the whole of the Bible speaks with one voice? Look at the next entry here, bottom of page 20. Again from Walter Kaiser, this time from his volume Toward Old Testament Efforts. "The most common misconception of the purpose of the law is that Old Testament men and women were brought into a redeemed relationship with God by doing good works. That is, by obeying the commands of the law, not through the grace of God. The truth of the matter is that this reading of the text will not fit the biblical evidence. The history of the Old Testament revolves, for the most part, around three covenants. The Abrahamic, the Sinaitic, and the Davidic covenants. The substance of these three covenants occupy a great deal of the Old Testament writer's attention and exhibits common material and concerns. However, most Old Testament scholars link the Abrahamic and Davidic covenants with royal grant types of treaties. Moshe Weinfeld demonstrated the royal or divine grants made to Abraham and David with their promise of land and house were unconditional gifts that were protected and assured, even if subsequent sins intervened. The gift might then be delayed or individually forfeited, but it had to be passed on to the next person in line. Thus, for Abraham and David, God's covenant was an everlasting covenant, even though there might arise some undeserving rascals who would not be able to participate in the benefits of that covenant, though they were obligated to transmit those same gifts onto their children. But the Sinaitic covenant is placed on a different footing, even though it shares much of the same substance with the Abrahamic and Davidic promises. It is not modeled on royal grant treaties, but on a vassal treaty form. To be sure, the vassal's obligations to obey in order to enjoy the benefits of this covenant are much more prominent. Now, that's a discussion we're talking more about the vassal treaty model for the Sinai covenant in a little bit. But you have these two types of covenants, sometimes called promissory covenants, Abrahamic, Davidic, and law covenant, the Sinai covenant. And some say the promissory covenants are unconditional, the law covenant is conditional. And some people, I think, overstate the contrast between them, because I don't think you can say that the Abrahamic Davidic covenants had no conditions, nor can you say that the law covenant has no promise. I think in a law covenant, the obligation is emphasized, in the promise covenant, the promise is emphasized, but not to the exclusion of conditional and promissory elements in the opposing form of government. That's another discussion. But notice where Kaiser goes with it. Several cautions must be raised at this point. First, both the Abrahamic and Davidic covenants also required obedience. You see, they weren't totally unconditional. Obedience was no spiritual luxury which the grace and goodness of the one bequeathing the grant had removed.
While the recipients did not earn these benefits, neither did they participate in them if they sinned and fell out of favor with the grantor. The best they could do in that sad event was to pass on these gifts to their children. They would participate in them if they walked in truth. Otherwise, it would skip their generation. Also, second, obedience to the law is not the source of blessing, but it augments a blessing already given. Only after the historical preface to the covenant document has affirmed that Yahweh's grace came first does the list of Yahweh's demands upon Israel begin. And this is the point that both Mokir and Wenham made. The grace of God is the atmosphere and context into which the Decalogue is cast. For its prologue states, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. That's grace. Likewise, before the specifications and stipulations of Deuteronomy 12 to 26 begin, Deuteronomy 1 to 11 lays the groundwork for such obedience by regarding Moses' sermons on the great redemptive actions of God in history that brought this covenant into existence. Blessing would indeed come after obedience, but not as a merited legal reward for the achievement of obedience to the law. The pattern in the Sinaitic covenant was, as Gordon Wenham has observed, God's choice, one, precedes man's obedience, two, but man's obedience is a prerequisite of knowing the full benefits of election, three. See, that's that same grace, law, grace. Schematic. Each of these three steps can be illustrated, as Wenham has, with a text like Exodus 19:4-5. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, how I brought you to myself. That's one. What God has done so far, that's grace. Now, if you will obey me fully and keep my covenant, Israel's obligation too, that's law. You will be my treasured possession, three. A promise of fuller benefits is added for obedience, but in the context of a grace already received in the gift. Accordingly, the priority and absoluteness of God's grace are constantly reiterated. The law then must not be viewed as an abstract, impersonal tractate that stands inertly over the heads of men and women. It was, first of all, intensely personal. God spoke from heaven. All the people could hear his voice. As any other people heard the voice of God speaking out of fire, as you have and live, the ultimate motivation for doing the law was to be like the Lord in holiness and action. Covenant aims to establish a personal relationship, not a code of conduct in the abstract. So I think it's important when we come to this foundational law to understand the way in which it functions. And it functions in the context of covenant. And it's not a meritorious means of salvation. And Israel did not speak rashly or improperly when they responded all that the Lord has said we will do. And there is not a contrast between the Old and New Testament, between law and grace, because grace was not existent in the Old Testament and law was not existent in the New Testament. I was astounded a few years back in this course. After the course, there was a student who was an older student who came up to me and said he had never realized before that there was grace in the Old Testament. That's a pretty astounding statement. But this was not someone who was unread in the scriptures or in the knowledge of the Bible, but that was the grid he had put on the Bible, that all the Old Testament grace is in it. And it seems to me, you know, this law of grace thing, very difficult to read the Old Testament and
not just the tremendous manifestation of the grace of God. I don't know whether I should go further with this, but let me give you one more citation here. There are some others that I'll skip. Those of you that have had Foundations in Biblical History have read some of Voss's biblical theology. Look at the bottom of page 22 and over on 23. This is kind of heavy stuff. But he's getting at an issue here that and for that matter, in the way in which certain statements are made in the New Testament about the way in which the law functions and works. Bottom of page 22. Paul says, this Pharisaic philosophy asserted that the law was intended on the principle of merit, to enable Israel to earn the blessedness of the world to come. It is true certain of the statements of the Pentateuch and the Old Testament in general may on the surface seem to favor the Judaistic position. That the law cannot be kept is nowhere stated in so many words. And not only this, that the keeping of the law will be rewarded is stated once and again. Israel's retention of the privileges of the covenant is made dependent on obedience. It is promised that he who shall do the commandments shall find life through them. Consequently, writers have not been lacking who declared that, from a historical point of view, their sympathies went with the Judaizers, not with Paul. Law was a meritorious means of salvation. Only a moment's reflection is necessary to prove that this is untenable, and that precisely, from a broad historical standpoint, Paul had far more accurately grasped the purport of the law than his opponent. The law was given, notice, after the redemption from Egypt had been accomplished, and the people had already entered upon the enjoyment of many of the blessings of the covenant. Particularly, their taking possession of the promised land could not have been made dependent on previous observance of the law. For during their journey in the wilderness, many of its prescripts could not be observed. It is plain, then, that law-keeping did not at that juncture, did not figure at that juncture as the meritorious ground of life and inheritance. The latter is based on grace alone. No less emphatically than Paul himself places salvation on that grace. But, while this is so, it might still be objected that law observance, if not the ground for receiving, is yet made the ground for retention of the privileges inherited. Notice what he's saying. Here, it cannot, of course, be denied that a real connection exists. But the Judaizers went wrong in inferring that the connection must be meritorious. That if Israel keeps the cherished gifts of Jehovah through observance of his law, this must be so because in strict justice they had earned them. And here's where Voss objects to that construal. He says the connection is of totally different kind. Yes, there is a connection between obedience and blessings. But it's not a meritorious connection, he says. The connection is of a different kind. It belongs not to the legal sphere of merit, but to the symbolico-typical sphere of appropriateness of expression. Now, what do you mean by that? He explains that in the next paragraph. As stated above, the abode of Israel in Canaan typified the heavenly, perfected state of God's people. Under these circumstances, the ideal of absolute conformity to God's law of legal holiness had to be upheld.
even though they were not able to keep this law in the falling spiritual sense, yea, even though they were not able to keep it externally and ritually, the requirement could not be lowered. When apostasy on a general scale took place, they could not remain in the promised land. Why? Here's what he said. When they disqualified themselves for typifying the state of holiness, they ipso facto disqualified themselves for typifying that of blessedness and had to go into captivity. So he says, yes, there is a connection between remaining in the land because of obedience, or being driven in the land because of disobedience, but that connection of blessing for obedience is not based on a meritorious ground of having earned it, but on what he calls a symbolic or typical sphere of appropriateness of expression. If they disqualify themselves for typifying the state of holiness, they thereby disqualify themselves for typifying that of blessedness, had to go with that duty. Now, that's, of course, pretty heavy theological kind of discussion of an issue, but it is a legitimate question to ask. What's the means of, what is the nature of the connection between blessing for obedience and person for disobedience? Now, I think you can say the person for disobedience is, yes, because it's merit. You disobey, you merit punishment. But when Israel obeyed, can you say that the blessing is merited? What Ross is suggesting is you do not. Whatever measure of obedience there is never going to be complete or perfect in any case. All right, questions, comments?
Yeah.
So before the Sinai, the people came to Moses regularly and asked him to resolve problems. What was their motivation then? Did they just want to eat the little
Well, I would assume their motivation then was they come to him when there was a dispute, and whatever the nature of the dispute, they wanted a settlement. And in connection with cases of that sort, and trying to settle arguments about whatever in any kind of civil relationship, Moses would give them some principles that would should be followed. So I would think it'd be more, they recognized that Moses was someone who was a mediator, and that what he said had divine authority. And they looked at him again to settle those disputes. I'm going to come back to that question in another connection shortly, so maybe we can go further with that when we discuss another issue. All right, D, the people's fear, that's in Exodus 20:18-21. That's after the giving of those Ten Commandments. When the people saw the thunder and lightning, heard the trumpet, saw the mountain smoke, they trembled with fear, stayed at a distance, said to Moses, speak to us yourself, we will listen. Do not have God speak to us, or we will die. So they asked Moses to mediate from God and himself. And that brings us to E. And that is, Moses is given the book of the covenant, Exodus 20, verse 22 through 23:33. If you glance through that material, Exodus 20, verse 22, you see immediately you have a regulation about how to make an altar and what is permissible or not permissible. And from that point through the end of chapter 23, you have a body of legal material
that I think is to be viewed as specific applications of the moral law to particular types of situations. In other words, the material in the Book of the Covenant stands at a different level of specificity or concreteness than does the foundational law. What you get in the legal material of the Book of the Covenant is application of the foundational law to specific types of situations. I think that can be illustrated if you look in your citations at pages 25 to 27. I don't want to read all this, but I want to just give you a couple examples taken from D.R. Hiller's book, Covenant, the History of a Biblical Idea. For example, you have the commandment in the foundational law, you shall not commit murder. You see that down two-thirds of the way down on page 25. That's one of the Ten Commandments. When you get to the Book of the Covenant, what you have is application of that principle to specific situations. Exodus 21:12-14, he who strikes a man a fatal blow shall surely be put to death. But he who did not act deliberately, as being an act of God, I will designate a place for you whither he may flee. But if a man maliciously plotted against his neighbor to slay him by a trick, you shall take him to be executed even from my altar. And then Exodus 21:18-25 gives another kind of a situation. If you go over to the next page, Exodus 21:28-32, if an ox gores a man or woman to death, the ox shall be stoned, its flesh shall not be eaten, the owner of the ox is free from blood, and so on. So you get that general principle, you shall not commit murder. Then you get that applied to specific types of situations in the material of the Book of the Covenant. Go down a little further on page 26. You shall not commit adultery, another one of the Ten Commandments. That becomes more specific in Exodus 22:15-16. If a man seduces a virgin who is not betrothed, lies with her, he shall make her his wife by paying the bride price, but if her father refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the bride price to the virgin. Top page 27, you shall not steal. You get a couple examples of that kind of a specific situation. Or you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. So, the Book of the Covenant stands at a different level of specificity or concreteness than does the foundation law. And that's why I think it's better to call the moral law of the Ten Commandments the foundation law. The content of the Book of the Covenant consists in regulations for Israel to follow in things such as worship, rights of Hebrew slaves, property rights, social responsibilities of various sorts. And most of them are formulated in what is called case law format. The case law format is if such and such happens, then this is the way you deal with that situation. And case law usually comes out of a long history of legal tradition and of customary practices that have built up over time that deal with certain types of situations and how it's best to handle them. The kinds of laws in there. Worship, rights of Hebrew slaves, property rights. I'll give you some references too. Worship in 20:22-26, rights of Hebrew slaves in 21:1-11, property rights in 22:1-14, and various other
sorts of social responsibility in 22:16-31. Now, here you have a law code called by many the covenant code. And the interesting thing is there were a number of extra-biblical law codes in the ancient eras that predate the Mosaic material found in the Book of the Covenant. I want to give you a number of examples of that, in fact, five of them. First is what's called the Ur-Nammu Law Code, which was a Sumerian law code from about 2000 BC. It came from the third dynasty of Ur. Ur of the Chaldees was down in southern Mesopotamia. That site, Ur of the Chaldees, was excavated by people from the University of Pennsylvania New Zealand early 1900s. There are a lot of artifacts from Ur from about 2000. And that's about the same time that Abraham did. So this is a law code from Abraham's time. We have the laws of Eshnunna, a century later. That's an Elamite city. That's near where present-day Baghdad is. The Elamites drove the Sumerians out of Ur, set up their own kingdom, and there's a law code that comes from them that dates to about 1900. There's the Lipit-Ishtar law code, 1870. That's also Sumerian from southern Mesopotamia. The Code of Hammurabi from Babylon, about 1700 BC. And then the Hittite laws from about 1500 BC. So there's at least five law codes that have been preserved and translated that predate the Mosaic Law Code. And because that's the case, it's of course become interesting to compare the laws that you find in the Book of the Covenant in Exodus with some of the laws that you find in these extra-biblical law codes. When you do that, you will find that at certain places, you will find remarkable similarities between the laws of the Book of the Covenant and the laws of some of these other ancient areas of law code. Probably the most clear law in the Book of the Covenant with respect to resembling the law from one of these extra biblical of the law codes is found in Exodus 21:28-32 about ox growth, where it says if a bull gores a man or a woman to death, the bull must be stoned to death. Its meat must not be eaten, but the owner of the bull will not be held responsible. If, however, the bull has had the habit of goring, and the owner has been warned but has not kept it penned up, and it kills a man or a woman, the bull must be stoned. The owner must also be put to death. However, if payment is demanded of him, he may redeem his life by paying whatever is demanded. This law also applies to the bull gores of son or daughter. The bull gores a male or female slave, the owner must pay 30 shekels of silver for the master of slaves. The bull must be stoned. But then verse 35. If a man's bull injures the bull of another and it dies, they are to sell the live one and divide both the money and the dead animal equally. So there's a case, kind of thing that doesn't bother us too much because we're not, you know, running the case of the rock square and too often. But that's probably a pretty common occurrence in an agricultural kind of society like this. They had to have a way to deal with it. But if you compare verse 35 with law 53 of the Eshnunna Code, Look what that says. If one ox gores another ox, causes its death, both ox owners shall divide between them the price realized in the sale of the live ox and buy the dead ox. Those are basically the same provisions. And you can find some other laws where, in one or the other of these law codes, you find a law quite similar to the formulation in the Mosaic Code. So, the question arises, when you recognize or observe that at the time in which this material was given by Moses to Israel on Mount Sinai, that the formulation of the laws cannot be completely isolated from the existing law of the time as far as the way in which the law is formulated, but seems to reach of the legal tradition of the time. It raises an interesting question. And the question is, how are we to regard or view the origin of the legal material of the Book of the Covenant? Must we say that all the legal material of the Book of the Covenant is entirely new, previously unknown legal formulations? Are all the laws and legal principles embodied in the laws of the Book of the Covenant something that was entirely unknown before the time of Moses, before he gave this material to the people of Israel after coming down from the mountain? In other words, if we are going to say that the character of these laws is, these laws are divinely sanctioned laws given by God through Moses to Israel, must we assume that their form has no connection whatever with the legal tradition of their time? I think when you read the Book of the Covenant, it becomes apparent pretty quickly that, as I already mentioned, the majority of the laws are in what's called this case law form. If such and such, my fear, recommends what does this, here's what we do about it. And that kind of case law format seems to be the codification of prior judicial pronouncements on particular types of legal problems. And it's common in all these ancient law codes. Now, with that in mind, when you read in Exodus 21:1, these are the laws you are to set before them. How do we understand that statement? What are the implications of it? I don't think the emphasis is so much that God dictated these laws to Moses verbatim, apart from existing legal tradition, but rather that God used and employed the knowledge Moses had of the legal traditions of his time in the formulation of a body of laws that carried divine sanction as the will of God for his people. And that's why I called your attention to that statement in chapter 18, Jethro's advice chapter, verse 16, where it says, or verse 15, because the people come to me to seek God's will, whenever they have a dispute, it's brought to me, I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and laws. Moses had spoken previously with divine authority in chapter 18 and had given the people the statutes of God and his laws.
I don't think there's any reason to conclude that the method of divine inspiration involved in that process, I don't think there's any reason to conclude that it would not have employed the legal knowledge and training that Moses had received while he grew up in Egypt in Pharaoh's household. And the education he received, he probably would have read these ancient authors. He would have been familiar with the legal tradition of the time. And God takes that up into the formulation of these laws that he then gives through Moses to his people. Now, I see my time's up. I want to go further with this because you have to put some qualifications there. I don't think that the conclusion that leads to is that this biblical material is borrowed from the extra biblical, because there are a lot of differences to that biblical. But there are connections. You don't isolate the formulation of these laws from the historical and cultural context in which they're set. And there are a lot of illustrations of that in the Old Testament.
Let's just put it in there. Let's confess, because I'm still alive.
Maybe, but I'm not sure.